Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guests today each tell stories of murder in the San Francisco Bay Area, but their stories are very different. Later in the hour, I'll be talking to clinical psychologist Matthew McKay about what happened after his son was murdered. My first guest, novelist Marie Sutro, is a proponent of adult literacy and volunteers with California Library Literary Services, helping adults improve their reading and writing skills. Her great-grandfather, grandfather, and father all served in the San Francisco Police Department, a fact which inspired her debut novel, Dark Associations. Growing up in the Bay Area, she listened to the sometimes harrowing, often hilarious stories of her dad's early experiences as an undercover cop with the San Francisco Police Department. Marie Sutro, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, Nancy.
Well, I mentioned that you volunteer with adult literacy and you help adults improve their reading and writing skills. And when I hear that, I think, well, composition skills. But I saw some of your handwriting, and it is so beautiful that I wonder if you ever help adults with their handwriting.
You know, I never have done that, but it was actually a funny story about how I honed the handwriting skills. I was in fifth grade, and I guess I was like many fifth graders. I just was going to write down whatever I needed to write as fast as I could. And my teacher was very inventive. She said, you know, if you do not improve your handwriting skills, you will not graduate to sixth grade. We will not let you go through. And I was so scared that I spent every waking moment.
Did she ever admit that that was an empty threat?
Yes, she did. Oh. At the end of the process. But hey, it worked.
It did. Your handwriting is lovely. And I was thinking that wouldn't that be nice if you taught others how to write so neatly?
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm sure my fifth grade teacher, Mrs. French, appreciates it too.
Oh, my goodness. So nice. Well, your book was interesting to me on several levels. First of all, the story, the characters. But on the cover of your book, there's in red this interesting design. And I'm not sure how you would describe that to listeners who can't see this design that is superimposed over the photograph on your cover. How would you describe that it actually is a rune?
Yes,
how would you
is.
Describe that for people?
Yes, it's an ancient Nordic rune. And what it looks like basically is a long vertical pole. And it has, for all intents and purposes, a triangle set in the side of it. It's kind of hanging there, as it were, from the midpoint of the vertical pole.
Well, when I first saw your book and saw that on the cover, I thought, what is that? And then as I read, I thought, oh my goodness, this is so fascinating to me because I spent hours in a museum in France. And the title of the museum is named for Champollion, who deciphered the Rosetta Stone.
Yes.
But in addition to his story is the story of world alphabets. And I'm so fascinated by this. All over the world, alphabets and languages. And I can just imagine if you were to go to that museum, you would also spend hours there.
Absolutely.
Where does this fascination with alphabets come from?
I think it's rooted in my same fascination with reading and writing. I love words, and you know, sometimes I'll hear people pronounce a word if it's in any language, you name it. Sometimes I'll just under my breath repeat the word because I love the sounds. I love how letters sound and phonics, and it's just always intrigued me. And when you link them together for meaning, whether it's an icon or it's actual written letters in any form or characters in other languages, it's just something that's always drawn me almost on a primitive level.
Well, in fact, when I began reading about this rune, I Googled the alphabet because I wanted to see all the others, too, and as a review because I was vaguely familiar with some of them. But I find that fascinating, and other readers might also. And if not, your story captivates them, I would think, your readers. Now, I was interested in something. I might remind listeners that my guest is Marie Sutro. Her novel is Dark Associations, and I call it a novel, but based on your conversations with your dad, I'm sure that these stories have some basis in reality.
Well, you know, the story itself is a wholly new story. It is inspired, obviously, by different types of cases. I took ideas from different cases over time. But where a lot of the inspiration came from, you know, hearing my dad tell stories when he was an undercover police detective, you know, there were just so many things that I wanted to draw from and incorporate into my characters in terms of sensibilities and things. So a lot of that does come directly from dad's stories.
And it does, as the reader, it rings true. It sounds like this is really the way it is, as opposed to totally invented. Now, something else that interested me, and I don't know if this was intentional or totally by accident, but I opened your book, and chapter one is dated January the 21st. Now, I haven't mentioned to listeners, but a week from tomorrow, on January 21st of this year, you're going to be at Barnes & Noble.
Yes, I am.
Now, did you choose that date on purpose?
You know, it's almost some sort of intergalactic kismet, if you will. I wrote the book, obviously, you know, with the publishing process, it takes a while for a book to get out to the public. But oddly, when I wrote the book, I knew I wanted it to start in, you know, in January. And I came up with this whole time frame. And as it turned out, the fates aligned for me, and it just all happened. So yes, the book signing in Barnes & Noble is the exact date of the start of the story.
Well, why don't you read the start of this story, chapter one, and this is taking place January 21st, and you start out with a big bad wolf, and we thought, what? The big bad wolf? So why don't you read that for us, Marie?
The big bad wolf eyed the beautiful young blonde woman. Innocence brimmed beneath the surface of her lustrous blue eyes. The wolf paused, momentarily gripped by a twinge of conscience. Perhaps it was wrong to take advantage of this girl. It seemed as egregious as pulling a new bud from a perfect rose or slaughtering a day-old calf. But there was something else in the young woman's eyes, a persistence born of drive and ambition. The wolf knew the combination well. It was a combination that burned in the dark black depths of her own eyes. So you were saying? The blonde perched on the edge of her seat, disconcerted by the long pause. Kate Barnes flashed the young woman a quick smile, much like the wolf to whom she had mentally equated herself moments before. I was saying that dealing with sexually deviant predators is not an easy occupation. But I mean, it's gotta feel good, right? Catching the bad guys and bringing them to justice? Maggie watched as her mentor's lips compressed into a straight line.
Okay, so far you've introduced two characters. One is kind of a red herring.
Yes.
There was no wolf. Yes. It actually was a young woman, Katie Barnes. And then Maggie is this innocent young blonde that you mentioned. So continue reading this for us.
Justice is a relative term, Maggie. Kate regarded the younger woman, deciding the girl was indeed innocent. With her golden locks, sun-kissed complexion, and cornflower blue eyes, Maggie was an all-American girl. She had been raised in Nebraska on the glowing ideals of truth, justice, and the American way. After graduating high school 2 years before, Maggie had moved to San Francisco, intent on earning a criminal justice degree from San Francisco State. Her ultimate goal was to enter law enforcement. That's when the dream would fade. Another bright young being would wither in the iron grasp of the system. Glowing ideals were great for school children, but in the wrong hands, they could be manipulated into weapons of mass destruction. She would learn, and it would cost her. But Kate had not been asked to deflower the student's idealism, merely to provide basic intel on what it meant to be a detective in the San Francisco Police Department's Special Victims Unit. That was easy enough, or so she'd hoped.
Okay, so at this point, we learn that Kate is a detective, and she is in the Special Victims Unit. And we don't know at this point, unless people happen to know, a Special Victims Unit. What are we supposed to understand about that?
You know, in my opinion, and probably for all of us, every victim is a special victim. And I think to law enforcement, that is the case. But there are certain types of crimes that fit a special mold, if you will, and those involve crimes involving, you know, sexual violence or, you know, violence towards children. So there's certain groups that deserve kind of that special attention and a group of specialists to deal with it.
So that's what we learned that Kate does.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then how does she get paired up with Maggie?
Well, we see that she, well, I could keep,
yes,
reading,
keep
if
reading
if you'd like.
Yes,
she had been paired with Maggie as a part of the department's latest attempt at community outreach. The expectation was that she'd mentor an SFSU criminal justice student for 3 weeks. Originally, she'd tried to duck the assignment, insisting she didn't have time. But the captain had been dead set on pairing Maggie with a female detective. Only two of the SVU detectives were equipped with the requisite ovary-uterus combo. One was out on maternity leave. Kate had won by default. The captain had even reassigned one of her cases so she could make time for Maggie. Pulling the case had helped, but not much. After all, time hadn't really been the main issue. It was the very idea of being a mentor. Mentors could have everlasting impacts on their protege. It was a role she was completely wrong for. There were dark things inside Kate, bad things she could not risk spreading to anyone else, especially a 22-year-old who couldn't even buy herself a beer.
Now, in that paragraph, Marie, you write, mentors could have everlasting impacts on their protégés. When we read that sentence at this point in the story, we don't realize how prophetic that was.
Right.
It would be scary if we knew at this point, but we don't. So here she was, continue if you would.
But here she was, sitting on the edge of the tired old couch in Maggie's apartment, feeling lupine and predatory in the presence of the radiant young woman. Kate glanced around, aware the apartment itself was a billboard for how different the two women were. Unlike her own immaculate and sparsely decorated Victorian unit, this place was cramped and cluttered. A dated oak entertainment center squatted across from the couch, struggling to support the ancient box-style television set jammed into its belly. Like the old piece of oak, the rest of the furniture screamed starving student. A panorama of smiling faces beamed at Kate from a variety of photos, which had been joyously tucked into every conceivable corner of the room. Besides Maggie, two other college co-eds dominated the exhibition, probably the roommates she had mentioned earlier. For all the tackiness and apparent overcrowding in the tiny apartment, there was an undercurrent of warmth and excitement. It wasn't just the heat radiating up from the tiny pizza parlor downstairs. It was something coming from the girls who lived here, an electric type of heat, fed by the anticipation of adulthood and the promise of a brilliant future. Conversely, an Arctic front chilled Kate's apartment year-round. The only photos adorning her home were landscape prints she'd picked up somewhere along the way. The next question caught her off guard. Have you ever come across a psychopathic serial killer? I mean, by the real definition? Kate was glad to hear Maggie's qualifier. The student had obviously paid attention in class. She knew to differentiate between the clinical definition of psychopath and the misapplied definition bandied about in popular culture. No, I haven't. You should have learned by now that serial killers are extremely rare. As I've told you before, this job isn't like what you see on TV or in the movies. It's about normal people who do horrible things. Kate's voice trailed off as her gaze turned inward. But aren't psychopaths normal people too? You know, like what friends and neighbors always say after they're caught? Kate exhaled slowly. Normal? No, psychopaths are not normal. Clinically speaking, they are sociopaths, which means they are incapable of empathy, guilt, or conscience. They are missing the most crucial elements that make us human. So they're like less than human? Perfect blonde eyebrows pulled into a troubled frown. But what about all the other perps you go after? Maggie swiped her finger across the iPad in her lap and read aloud. Child molesters, rapists, murderers, aren't they horrible too? Of course they are, but their motivations are as varied as their opportunities for rehabilitation. Psychopaths, on the other hand, do what they do because they want to, not because something traumatic forced them to. And they never feel guilt or remorse for what they've done. Kate paused, wanting to drive her point home. Psychopaths cannot be rehabilitated because they are capable of understanding that what they've done is wrong. Then what should we do with them? Just stick them in jail for the rest of their lives? Kate's thoughts returned to the justice system she served, a system that rarely lived up to its name. I guess so. Come on, Kate. Don't guess. Tell me what you really think. Maggie leaned over and playfully slapped her mentor's knee. The detective drew back from the contact. Aware she'd gone too far, the student settled awkwardly back into her seat. The girl was nothing if not direct. Kate figured she deserved an honest answer. Kill them.
This is novelist Marie Sutro reading from her novel, Dark Associations. We've met the two characters in conversation. One is a student and her other her mentor. And when Maggie says, what should we do with these psychopaths? Kate said, kill them. And she at the time had no idea where that comment would lead. And of course, we don't want to spoil things for the listeners. I want to go back to something you said. Maggie swiped her finger across the iPad in her lap and read aloud. And as I was reading this novel, I was saying, oh, this is not your grandmother's detective story. Because this is the first mention of the iPad, but then the officers are all, and it makes sense these days, that they're pulling out their iPads and they're using their iPads. Facebook plays a big role in your novel. So you really bring things up to date. Now, when your dad is telling you about his days as an undercover cop, I wouldn't think this new technology was available to him, or maybe it was. Maybe your dad was still an undercover cop.
No, it wasn't, and it's interesting. You know, one of the things that's always fascinated me, especially when I look at crime thrillers, there's always the famous case of Jack the Ripper. Mm-hmm. And you look at, you know, how far we've come with forensics and all of the technology of detection, you know, and part of that comes into the heavy forensic tools and, you know, other things like what do the cops use? Do they use cell phones and do they use iPads and how do they communicate? And it's interesting because you'd think, gee, we've come so far, and we should be able to catch all of these folks, but we're still not quite there yet because as far as law enforcement comes, unfortunately, the bad guys are coming along. So, you know, in this novel, I tried to, you know, integrate those elements that are have become commonplace in society, common technology, and find unique ways to weave the story in with them.
Okay. Well, I might remind listeners that your great-grandfather, your grandfather, and your father all served in the San Francisco Police Department, and that's what inspired this novel, is that you have this background of your family and the men in your family being policemen, and specifically your dad with his experience as an undercover cop. Did you, when he was telling you these stories, did it occur to you at that time, boy, this would make a good book?
Well, you know, there was the side of things where, you know, when we grew up, my father would not keep his phone number. That was always something we didn't keep our phone number listed because my father obviously came in contact with certain people and testified against people and was cognizant of those issues. So even after he had left the police department, there was still this awareness, you know. So it's just kind of an interesting aspect that we grew up with, whether it was the stories or just kind of an adaptation of that lifestyle of being aware of your surroundings and being aware of situations. So it's kind of something you almost picked up through osmosis.
Well, I would think today the problem is even worse with the internet. The bad guys can track you down in ways that weren't available earlier. That's pretty scary.
It is, and I think it just goes back to, you know, the same old rules of being around and being aware of what goes on around us.
Is it a spoiler alert to say who we find murdered in our story?
No, I don't think that it's a spoiler alert if you tell who that first murderer is.
Yeah, okay, because I would like you to read how the first victim is discovered. And would you flip over to page 13 in your book? This is chapter 2.
Certainly.
So it's a couple of days later. It's January 25th now, 4 days later.
It was all about faith, not the Bible-thumping, obnoxious type of faith doled out by wily political groups, but a quiet belief living deep inside your soul. Without it, running across the wooden bridge spanning the lake would be impossible. Well, maybe not in the middle of September. It was one of the few months of the year San Francisco lived up to the sunny expectations of its California address. But on this cold January morning, the ever-present fog had enveloped the far side of the bridge completely. On either side of the wooden rails, the tranquil waters of Lake Merced appeared as liquid mercury, reflecting the silvery wet blanket nestled tightly around them. As Warren Benth ran, his circle of visibility moved with him, as if some stagehand was following his progress with a giant fog-proof spotlight. he thundered across the weathered wooden planks, accompanied by resounding staccato footfalls. The previous night had been such a mess. The ever-so-sexy personal trainer he'd been dating for the past 2 months had finally brought up the dreaded M-word. The M-word wasn't in Warren's vocabulary, at least not now. He was committed to making a name for himself at the advertising agency he'd called home for the last 4 years. After grad school, he had landed a sweet position creating advertising campaigns for local tech companies. Starting as a lowly intern, he'd fought to impress the partners. His hustling soon paid off, earning him a corner office and the promise that if he brought in a few more large accounts, he might be up for a junior partnership. It was all about keeping his clients sold on the importance of social media and avoiding the M-word. The M-word led to kids, mortgages, Little League, and various equally nauseating anchors. He might as well just tie a real anchor around his throat and jump into the lake. No, the M-word was a fast track to nowhere, and Warren was definitely going somewhere. So last night, he had opted for honesty and been repaid with a crying jag that roared full throttle until he had unceremoniously dropped that pretty little gal back on her doorstep.
Okay, at this point in your story, we meet this guy that we have no idea how he fits into the story. He seems to come out of nowhere. And the fact that he is savvy with social media is an important thing that we don't know the role it's going to play when we're reading this. So here's this young guy, like in his late 20s, 29, you say he is. And so he's, well, continue reading that part, Mary.
Shaking his head to banish the memory of her piercing wail, Warren made it to the far side of the bridge, then followed the path to the left. Normally, he would have bypassed the bridge shortcut and conquered the entire lake trail. But he had had an early conference call this morning and couldn't spare the time. Instead of following the winding path back around the east side of the lake, he planned to make up more time by running along Lake Merced Boulevard. Earlier, he'd left his car in the lot near Skyline Boulevard. As long as he stuck to the route and kept a good pace, he'd be there in plenty of time to return to his condo for a quick shower before heading to the office. Rounding the next curve in the path, something hit him. Not physically, but instinctively, and it packed a wallop. First he tried ignoring the feeling, but it grew so insistent he was forced to slow to a walk. As a kid, he'd often played comic book superheroes with his friends, always calling early dibs on the beloved wall crawler Spider-Man. Back then, he'd spent countless hours trying to imagine what it would be like to have a real spider sense. With the lake at his back and the path lost in the fog ahead, Warren finally knew. Hands on his hips, he walked in a slow circle, trying to identify what had set his internal fearometer on high. He jogged this trail almost every morning for the last 2 years. Nothing seemed out of place, except... He spun around to his right and faced the De Anza statue. Perched on its concrete pedestal, the statue itself looked pretty much the way it did every day. But this morning, Don Juan Bautista De Anza, founder of the city of San Francisco, was not alone as he sat in a regal bronze cast above his horse. Today, he appeared to have a companion. Warren took a few steps toward the statue and stopped abruptly. A naked female dummy was sitting astride the horse right in front of De Anza. What a stupid prank, the things some people thought were funny. Warren was about to turn back and finish his run when he noticed the blood. It flowed generously in thick, wet rivulets down the side of his horse. Staring at the blood made him aware of the almost impossible way the body had been positioned. He walked around the front of the statue, never taking his eyes from the body. It was there, facing old De Anza himself, when Warren realized it wasn't just the legs that hung astride the horse. A good portion of the body itself did, too. Someone had cut the torso, upward through the crotch, tearing open the abdomen. Then Warren, up-and-coming advertising guru extraordinaire, ran to the bushes and launched the most explosive campaign of his career.
This is novelist Marie Sutro reading from her novel, Dark Associations. And we've just met this character for the first time. He's out jogging. This is realistic because often bodies are discovered by people out walking their dogs, going out for a jog. And we also notice, one, you mentioned that he is advertising. He's in advertising. He uses social media. And he's in a hurry because he's got a meeting. He's got to get back and get back to the office. And he doesn't have time for what's going to happen because here he is. He discovered a body. The police aren't going to say, okay, thanks, and let him go on his way. So this creates a problem when the police arrive on the scene. So here's an example of how a body is discovered. And if these young women are being murdered in the Bay Area, their families have to be notified.
Yes.
And you have a scene in your book of what it's like to tell a mother to break the news to her. So just give us a little bit of this. This is on page 111 in your book, Marie.
Kate pressed the doorbell. Hurried footsteps from within conveyed a frantic sense of urgency. A 50-ish blonde woman with a thick midsection answered the door. Clad in jeans and an old sweatshirt, with her hair thrown into a hasty ponytail, she was clearly a mother laden with concern. Her eyes flew frantically from Harding to Frey, then settled on Kate. Recognition flashed in her eyes, drawing her brows together, teasing the light wrinkle at their center into a deep channel. Harding held his badge up for her inspection. Angela Hammonds? I'm Detective Harding with the San Francisco Police Department. We're here about Becky. The worried mother stepped toward Harding, hope welling up in her features. Have you found her yet? No, but as I said on the phone, you can help us to do that by answering our questions. May we come in? Yes, please. Angela backed inside, waving them inward. Closing the door behind them, she ushered them into a rectangular room with a dining area at one end and a modern kitchen at the other. Angela took a seat at the end of the large mahogany table. Kate and Frey sat to her right, Harding to her left. Ms. Hammonds, this is Special Agent Frey, and this is my partner, Detective Barnes. She peered at Kate across the table. Aren't you the officer who helped Becky when she lived in San Francisco? Her voice trailed off at the mention of the city, as if its very name might be a catalyst for reigniting a painful chapter in her daughter's history. Yes, I am. Kate fixed the woman with a level stare.
So this comes as a surprise. They go in to talk to this mother, tell they have not found her daughter, and then they learn that Kate happens to know this young woman.
Yes.
And her mother says, aren't you? And she has to say yes. And, of course, they assure the mother they're going to do everything they can to find her daughter. And they ask her some more questions. So I would imagine, now you never went with your dad to on any of his work. It was just the stories that he told you.
Yes. And, it's a very fascinating thing, the human side of that job and the challenges that are presented in it. I think sometimes it's easy to forget that, for as much as, Hollywood and TV, we put the police officers up on a pedestal and we look at, oh, wow, are they a great detective? And do they solve it Sherlock Holmes style? But, there was the element of Holmes that, every once in a while, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle would let you see that personal side and how the cases would affect him. And that's something that was always fascinating to me.
Yeah, because I'm sure it would be hard to, some of the situations you describe in your book, hard for the police officers to do that kind of job. I mean, some aspects of it are interesting, but some just would be heartrending. And so some of your book is hard to read. I'll have to admit that. Some of it is very interesting. You go in when the medical examiner is doing his job. That, of course, is quite interesting. So I want to remind readers that you will be at Barnes & Noble on the 21st of January. And your book is Dark Associations. Thank you, Marie. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise. Thank you, Nancy.
After a short break, I'll be talking to clinical psychologist Matthew McKay about a very different story of murder in the San Francisco Bay Area. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Before I introduce Professor McKay, I would like to remind listeners that the views of my guests do not necessarily reflect those of North State Public Radio. Matthew McKay is a clinical psychologist and professor at the Wright Institute in Berkeley. He co-founded Haight-Ashbury Psychological Services in San Francisco in 1979 and served as its clinical director for 25 years. Currently, he serves as the director of the Berkeley Cognitive Behavior Clinic. Books he has co-authored on professional and self-help psychology have sold more than 3 million copies. When his son Jordan was murdered, Dr. McKay set out on a quest to discover the truth about why we are here and what happens when we die. He was able to connect with Jordan across the life-death divide in more than 100 conversations and has written a book, Seeking Jordan, How I Learned the Truth About Death and the Invisible Universe. Matthew McKay, welcome.
Glad to be with you.
Now, I say that like it was so easy that you just connected with your son after he passed over, but how did you do that?
Well, it took some doing. The first step was going to Chicago and meeting with Dr. Alan Botkin, who had developed something called induced after-death communication, and going through that experience and through that experience, hearing Jordan's voice and having the first experience of really connecting to him after his death. And yet that was a passive experience. I was only hearing his voice. I was getting messages that were important to me, messages for his mom, important to her. I was learning that he was okay, he was happy, and of course that he, the soul of Jordan, still existed. But I wanted to have a chance to do more than just hear his voice. I was so grateful for that, and yet I wanted to ask questions, and I wanted to have a conversation with him as we had had so many hundreds of times around the kitchen table. And to that end, I enlisted Ralph Messner, who's also a specialist in after-death communication. Dr. Messner taught me how to do channeled writing, also called automatic writing. And through channeled writing, I was able to, first of all, I found it very easy to do. I have no skills or gifts in terms of psychic abilities, but it was something I could do, that was achievable for me, and I was able to begin having conversations with Jordan and learning not just how he is and where he is, but a lot about the nature of the afterlife, about why we come to Earth to begin with, and our purpose. And it just opened so many doors to understanding things that I thought never possible in this lifetime to know.
And you say that you did not have any special skills or talents, and so we should assume from that that any of us, if we're receptive, that we can receive messages from loved ones who have crossed over. You happen to receive it in automatic writing. It's sometimes called automatic writing, this channeled writing. But you also say there are other ways, depending on the person, that they might receive information other ways. What are some of these other ways?
Well, of course, I mean, one of the things that so many people do, and that we did too after Jordan died, was to consult a medium. And to we brought our list of questions for the medium, and through the auspices of that person, we were able to get some answers and hear some of what Jordan had to say. Although, again, it came through someone else. It wasn't direct communication that we were having with him. Shamanic practices are also very powerful, and we've done some of that. Even things as simple as shamanic drumming, which creates an altered state experience, and then asking questions and visualizing in that altered state can make it possible to connect to the people on the other side. So there are a number of ways that people reach across, and shamanic processes, meditation, auto-hypnosis, being able to it's actually very simple to hypnotize oneself. It's a process that most people can do, and makes people receptive to hearing from the other side and asking questions and getting answers and so forth. So there's quite a few ways that people have been able to reach across, and many of them are actually doable without any training, particular training or ability.
Well, I can just imagine a listener thinking, my goodness, here's a serious scientist, and he's going to see mediums? I would never do that. And you may have thought that yourself.
Well, I think that there actually is a lot of data on mediumship and what it has to say. You can't rely on any one medium. You don't take it as gospel what a particular person claiming to have psychic or mediumship abilities tells you. But in fact, if you look at the whole history of mediumship and look at what generally has come through, there's an amazing amazing similarity in terms of what the messages are. John Climo's book on channeling looks a lot at the history of mediumship, and one of the things that's just so amazing is that the picture of the afterlife, life purpose on Earth, the process of reincarnating, all of that is just absolutely across the board very similar across many different mediums and channelers.
Well, what do they say happens when we die?
Well, one of the things that's really clear, and that this is has been reported over and over again, Jordan reports it to me, and when I do life between life hypnotic regressions with people, they will report during the regression that the very first thing that happens is we get to a landing place where, and it's not a material universe anymore. We're not in where atoms and electrons are whirling around. Everything is produced by energy and thought. And where we arrive is a place that's specifically designed for us to create safety, familiarity, comfort, and to ease the transition between a bodied, an embodied state and a spirit-based experience. So we're led into a place very immediately after death where we actually get a certain sense of peace. We're greeted by guides, by oftentimes by loved ones, and we start getting used to not being in a body. We notice immediately that we can see 360. We can see all around. We're not relying on eyes that look forward. Our awareness is a complete circle. We also notice that we have the appearance of legs, but don't have to walk. We can move simply by thinking or directing our attention to something else. And what's interesting about that is that we have to get used to the idea that movement no longer requires effort. It simply requires intention. So all of this is happening in that first little while in the landing place. And gradually we're led to realize that this is just energy, this is just thought. And if you're in a beautiful meadow, it's lovely, the sun overhead, the wind, all of that is created for our sense of peace and familiarity. So that's the first place we go, and many, many channelers and mediums agree that's what it looks like. It's different for everyone, but its purpose is to create familiarity and comfort.
My guest is clinical psychologist Matthew McKay, who is a researcher and professor at the Wright Institute in Berkeley. And you've been telling us when we die, for example, if we find a forest a scary place, we wouldn't find ourselves in a forest then if that was not something that we found soothing and comforting.
And in fact, scary bardos, where people are, face demons and strange creatures and
as in the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Yes, no one reports that in modern times. It's not something that anybody is seeing. We're not encountering demons and evil spirits and so forth. So it may be, you know, the Book of the Dead, both the Tibetan and the Egyptian Books of the Dead, were written for the most part under the influence of drugs. And this is a well-documented fact. And so the priests and seers who were writing these books were taking substances to enhance their spiritual openness. But it may be that those substances created images that really were the product of the substance of the drug, a bad trip, as opposed to what's really there on the other side. So much of the early writing about after-death experience is so, shall we say, mediated through chemical substances that are affecting the brain and altering our perception, that we have to take some of that with a grain of salt. It just isn't we don't see that in modern mediumship or channeling.
Well, we often hear of this event called, somebody says, well, gosh, I almost died. My life passed before my eyes. And there's actually apparently some basis in reality, if we want to call it that, in that there is a life review after the person passes over.
And that's right. And the near-death experience in which we have this very rapid flashing of awareness of you know, events in our life is not apparently the same thing as what happens in the afterlife, which is a much slower, much more deliberate process. After the initial landing phase, some souls need repairing. They've had a difficult life. They've struggled. Soul energy needs to be, they call it remodeling. It's simply just making the energy, smoothing it out and making it less disturbed. And so some souls really need to sort of go to a spiritual hospital for a while to kind of recuperate, but many do not, and they will move directly from the landing place to a life review process, which is really a kind of meditation that is supervised by guides and masters who help us look back. Essentially, we're looking back at a part of the Akashic record that is our life. And in that review process, from what I understand from Jordan and what I've experienced, the life review is not just looking at it from our own perspective, each event, each choice we made, not just seen from our own perspective, but seen from the perspective and the experience of everyone around us. So we get to experience exactly what they felt, how they reacted, what they went through in response to choices and decisions and actions that we took in the course of our lives. We not only experience this kind of surrounding, all of these experiences that other people have at the moment of our choice, but on into the future, so we can see the rolling effect over time of everything that we do. It's an extraordinary experience. It's enormously enlightening because we start to understand the depths of cause and effect, that when I do this, here's what happens to the souls around me. Here's how they react. Here's how they feel. And I get to actually feel all of that. So it's a profound experience that is a vital part of our learning. In our embodied life, we only see things from our own perspective. We have a certain amount of empathy, and we sometimes hear from others about how our behavior affects them, but we don't really know it in the same way we do during life review. So it's an extraordinary opportunity to learn, and it takes time. And for souls who have lived, shall we say, a reckless life without spending a lot of time thinking about the impact of their decisions on others. The life review is often very arduous. It's very difficult, and it is actually painful. There is no hell in the afterlife. The closest the afterlife has to hell is a life review in which we have to look back on a lot of deeds and decisions that cause great hurt to others, because we then have to feel all of that hurt ourselves.
My guest is Dr. Matthew McKay, who is a clinical psychologist and written a book, Seeking Jordan, How I Learned the Truth About Death and the Invisible Universe. I could see how that life review might be misinterpreted by religious people as a judgment, but you say it's not that at all.
There is no judgment, and in fact, the masters and the guides who support us throughout life review take the position that we are simply having the opportunity to learn and understand and gain wisdom. This is not about were you right or wrong, and it's not about moral issues of good and bad. It's about recognizing the truth of how actions impact others and what happens when we do certain things in life and choose certain things in life. And it's just about gaining that knowledge. And so there's a lot of support. There's a lot of appreciation for how hard our lives are here, how easy it is to make choices to just try to protect ourselves from pain or get caught in the in seeking pleasure. There's an acknowledgement that this life is very, very challenging. And so it's not a judgment that we've screwed up. It's simply a recognition that our choices do have enormous impact and learning from them.
Well, since you are communicating with Jordan, we get to see maybe what their similarities with what other people experience. For example, the first thing he wanted to do was to reassure you and his mother that he was okay, that he loved you. And then after that, what is life like in this life that he is living in between his earthly life, one earthly life, and perhaps another earthly life?
Well, actually, very shortly after we go through life review, we move on to join our soul group. And the way Jordan explains soul groups is, if you think about the world we live in, we have these far-flung cities and countries, but our own little piece of that is where we sleep at night. It's our house or our apartment. It's so a soul group, you might think of it as the soul's most immediate spiritual family. And the soul groups run from around 6 to 20 souls. And we go through time and many, many, many incarnations with those same people. And they're like a little repertory company. We're reincarnating back on Earth with those same souls over and over and over again, but in different relationships. In some cases, a soul will be a mate, a sexual partner. In other cases, siblings, children, your favorite bartender, someone who was your teacher. A dear friend. So souls in our soul group over many lifetimes will have many different kinds of relationships to us, just as people in actors in a repertory company will have many, many different roles, and yet it's the same group of actors that are appearing in play after play. So our soul group in the life between lives digest lessons from the last immediate life and the many of lives that we've lived together. We also are engaged in other learning experiences in the life between lives, learning certain kinds of spiritual practices, for example, learning how to create things out of thought, learning how to help souls who are distressed, learning how to guide and communicate to souls who are incarnating to help support them through the vicissitudes of life. So souls in the life between lives are, reviewing the past lives, learning from that, and also learning spiritual skills that they use in the life between lives. So it's a place, again, of learning, just like the earth is a place of learning. but learning different things.
My guest is Matthew McKay, who has written a book, Seeking Jordan, How I Learned the Truth About Death and the Invisible Universe. Now, I came to a point in your book where I put the book down and tried to answer this question that came up when I was reading your book. And I think even if people can't swallow what you're saying, Dr. McKay, they can't say, this is just something that is too far out there that for me to accept. But you mentioned this idea of a flaw that you are working on in this lifetime. And so I think that would be a helpful thing to people to take a look at. What flaw am I working on this lifetime? Is there a better word than flaw? How do you explain that?
Well, let's start with the word karma, because karma is really our lesson plan. And the lesson plan that we have is just the things that we're learning often goes across a number of different lifetimes, because it may take us more than one life to learn some of the key lessons. The flaw that we come to Earth to explore and overcome is really a crucial part of that lesson plan of our karmic responsibilities here. So the flaw is, you know, and the flaw may be hubris or self-focusedness, selfishness. That's a flaw that I struggle with. It's a lot of being rather self-focused and having to really learn how to direct my attention away from myself to the souls around me. But each soul has a flaw, and the flaw is really more important, or this lesson that we're learning. If we can call the flaw the lesson, the key lesson, it's more important than really our attributes, our skills, and our the things that we boast and feel good about, because that's what we came to work on. That is our reason for incarnating again here, is to work on that flaw, that lesson.
So that's why we are here.
That's why we are here. We're not here, according to Jordan, everything that I've experienced, for salvation. We're not trying to earn a place in heaven. We already have that. We go to the afterlife and we go to our soul group, and that's a given. There is no hell. There are no bardos of pain where we struggle in between lives to pay back for our sins.
Well, you were saying that you think you figured out what your flaw is, if we want to call it that, that you are working on in this lifetime. And I didn't come up with a satisfactory answer. I'm still working on that question. But from your book, I gather that's why some people have a hypnotic regression that can help clarify their life purpose now.
One of the things that you can do, there are hypnotherapists who specialize in past life and life between life regressions, or regressions to the spirit world. And I've done that with quite a few people. I've had it done for me as well. And it's a very powerful experience, because one of the things you learn when you go to the life between lives, not only do you learn about the life review and your soul group, but one of the last things you look at is your life selection, the process by which we select this next body that we are going to live in, and this next family, and this next environment, and this next era. All of that we select. We're given a number of choices, and with the support of guides and masters, we make a decision as to which life we want to enter. And often the decision is made is, what do I need to learn, and which life affords me the best opportunity for the lessons that I'm working on, from the karmic lessons that I'm really most involved in right now. So we go back and we make that decision, and we can review that using hypnosis to see how the person made the decision to enter this particular life, the current life that they are now in, and what were the lessons and what was the life purpose that they anticipated they would have in this incarnation. What are they here to learn? What are they here to do? And all of that is available as we look at that moment of choice, that moment of deciding which life they are going to have in this next incarnation.
My guest is Matthew McKay. He is a clinical psychologist, a researcher, and professor at the Wright Institute in Berkeley, and his book is Seeking Jordan, How I Learned the Truth About Death and the Invisible Universe. In fact, you wrote the first four chapters of your book, but really you and Jordan co-wrote the next nine chapters.
That's exactly right. I think I was just the scribe that taking dictation, essentially, from Jordan for almost all of the last part of the book. I would simply ask questions that were based on an outline he had given me earlier. And I'd ask the question, and I would wait and just start writing as fast as I could as I began downloading the answer from him. And oftentimes, I'd have to write for pages just to answer a single question, and when that stopped, then I could go on to the next question and hear his next answer. So the process of that part of the book was just asking questions and having Jordan respond and give as complete an answer as he wanted to give until we went on to the next subject, next item. And it was, in a way, my role was very passive. The only thing I had to be was curious and allow and be open to whatever he could tell me.
Well, you know, if I were to try that, I've never tried automatic writing or channeled writing, but I would think, am I making this up? That's what would keep, I would think I was making it up.
And that's really important what you're saying, because everyone who does channeled writing, and I mean, we're talking documented stories of many, many, many channelers across time, have wondered about that, have struggled with the question, is this just my mind, or am I really talking to an entity on the other side?
Well, thank you so much, Dr. McKay. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I think you've at least, even with the skeptics, you have maybe given them ideas of something they might want to consider. Thank you again.
Much appreciated.
My guest has been Dr. Matthew McKay. His book is Seeking Jordan, How I Learned the Truth About Death and the Invisible Universe. I would like to thank my first guest, author Marie Sutro. Her novel is Dark Associations, and she will be at Barnes & Noble a week from tomorrow on January 21st. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.